Formosa Files is sponsored by the Frank C. Chen Cultural Foundation. Frank Chen, Chen Qichuan, served as the mayor of Kaohsiung City from 1960 to 1968 and founded the Kaohsiung Medical College.
Formosa Files.
John and I were chatting recently about China's increasingly military assertiveness against Taiwan. You know, all those unwelcome visits by PRC planes and ships, they've been in the news. I mean, just last week, for example, the Japanese newspaper Nikkei News had an article with this headline: China's military speeds preparations to blockade Taiwan.
The article details how China has been holding drills and having ships and planes practice what looks like a joint naval and aerial blockade, the complete containment of Taiwan.
And things really heated up after then U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan in 2022. And it's not just a matter of numbers of military hardware either. There's been a notable change in the deployment of Chinese military planes and ships. So before, they very rarely moved around to the east side of Taiwan.
Right. They usually operated southwest of Taiwan and quite far away.
But now, the Chinese have become active in the waters to the east of Taiwan, the Western Pacific Ocean, and they're putting everything from aircraft carriers to drone divisions out there.
Yes, both reconnaissance drones and combat drones. And aircraft carriers, plural aircraft carriers, because they now have two. And a third one is due next year. And there have been lots of airplanes, of course.
So military experts are divided on China's ability to launch a full invasion of Taiwan, you know, the kind of Normandy-style amphibious landings, men and machines hitting the beaches. But I think it's fair to say the consensus is that the PRC is capable of blockading the island.
And it looks like they're getting ready for such a blockade.
Yes, but Formosa Files is a history podcast, so let's quit the 21st century and head back in time, but we're staying with the theme. So has Taiwan ever been blockaded?
Eric, do you remember Operation Causeway?
Absolutely. That was a fascinating story. It's an American invasion plan for Taiwan, but this was aborted. They aborted the plan in late 1944. Instead, the U.S. military leapfrogged or jumped over Formosa, and they went from Luzon in the Philippines to Okinawa, skipping Taiwan.
Right. So Taiwan was not invaded, but the U.S. kind of blockaded the island with ships and especially submarines, and its airfields and ports were neutralized with bombers.
So perhaps not a standard definition of a blockade, but effective, yeah?
Yes. If we're not just talking about the main island of Taiwan, then there was an attempted blockade of Jinmen Island back in 1958 during the Second Taiwan Strait Crisis.
Jinmen, a very small island near the Chinese coast held by the ROC. And when we say very near the Chinese coast, like, very close.
You can see it. The Chinese wanted to stop the nationalist troops on Jinmen from being resupplied, so they put a blockade in. Their attempt to blockade it was largely by artillery from the mainland, blasting the island and the surrounding waters.
So we're talking about communist troops here. They wanted to stop nationalist troops on Jinmen from being resupplied.
Yes. The United States sent ships and airplanes to assist the ROC ships, and the blockade was lifted.
John, that's a rather understated way of putting it. Breaking that blockade had, the Soviets, the Chinese, the U.S., all looking at Jinmen and all thinking this could be the flashpoint leading to the use of atomic weapons and World War III.
Good point. Yes, I think it was probably the first serious nuclear crisis of the nuclear age, 13 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Okay, well, going back in time, there was a naval blockade of Taiwan. In 1884 to 1885, Taiwan was at that time caught up in the Sino-French War. John, you recently did a two-part episode on the Battle of Danshui. I think you were talking with another John Groot, yeah?
Yeah, we did a two-part series on the Battle of Danshui, a short but humiliating defeat for the French. Their ships were stopped from going up the river, and the Marines they landed were repulsed. This was in early October 1884.
The French imposed a naval blockade around the island later that month on October 23rd, 1884, and it would continue until April the next year, 1885. So the failure to capture Dinchray was a significant defeat for the French, as you noted. Dinchray was strategically important. That's the port for Chinese supplies coming in for the Qing Dynasty forces. Who was their commander again? Oh, yeah. Liu Mingchun, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There was also the matter of losing face. The French not making progress at Geelong and actually losing in Dinchray. The French needed a victory to recover prestige and also to secure a better position for bargaining, negotiating.
So they stepped up military operations and also imposed a blockade to prevent Chinese reinforcements and supplies coming to Taiwan.
Yes. Jules Paternotre, the French minister to China, resident in Shanghai, he said in a telegram to Paris that, quote, "The blockade of Taiwan appears in effect necessary to prevent the shipment of Chinese reinforcements." And he said a blockade, quote, "can be equally useful to impede the news of our failure from spreading throughout China," end quote.
Interesting. So the French had a superior navy, and they were able to blockade the northern Formosan ports of Geelong and Dinchray. And to a more limited extent, they were also able to blockade, sort of, some ports in the south. It was only a partial success. Small ships, Chinese junks, they could still get through from China to Taiwan's western coast. And then troops and supplies would head north overland.
When the French announced the blockade, they hoped not to upset their fellow Western powers too much. They explained that for neutral nations, they would not exercise the right of visit and capture upon the vessels on the high seas, what is called a belligerent blockade.
The French, they said they would just forbid access to the blockaded ports of Taiwan. The British disagreed with this interpretation. They saw it as belligerent, and they were worried about possible fallout for their traders, other citizens. And they were also concerned that anger against one European nation, so in this case France, would cross over to another, Britain, and they were worried about their business interests in China.
The British tried hard to maintain neutrality in this undeclared war, but things can get messy. For example, private British ships were chartered by Chinese, and then these were seized by the French.
The French didn't have enough ships to carry out a complete blockade. So the major ports were blockaded, but there were smaller ports along the western coast. Small ports, so not suitable for large steamships. But that was fine, because Chinese junks and small vessels could get in. So Dinchray and Geelong are blocked in the north, and a few French ships down in the south are trying to stop entry into Anping and Tainan and Takao, or Kaohsiung.
The blockade was a limited success, as you said. There was an economic impact on Formosa, especially on tax revenue, the official trade coming by steamship through the customs ports, but unofficial trade continued.
And the Qing could get troops and supplies into Taiwan.
Yes, and the war dragged on, and the French were frustrated, and they took this frustration out on innocent junks. Ships not bringing in supplies. These were cruel attacks on small vessels, sometimes blown up, put to fire. Yeah, crews seized and then taken as laborers for building fortifications at Geelong.
Aggressive. And this aggressive approach was criticized by the British. They also expressed their disapproval when in February of 1885, the French declared that rice would be considered a contraband of war.
Contraband of war. Huh. Normally, this would be vital war supplies, something like ammunition.
Yeah, not rice. And 30 years later, the British themselves would have a naval blockade of Germany in World War I, and food was very much a part of the reason for doing that. But Taiwan, we have enough rice, right? We won't be starved out.
That's right. Targeting rice was part of the wider Sino-French War of reducing rice transports from southern China to Beijing up in the north.
Back then, we called it Peking, yeah? So the Sino-French War ended in April 1885. After 7 months, both sides were just tired of this expense and they had other matters to deal with. So basically the blockade just went away.
The Sino-French War started as a dispute over Tonkin, what is today northern Vietnam. But Taiwan was dragged in because, as an island, the French could take advantage of the Chinese having a very weak navy.
Likewise, the blockade. The French chose this strategy because of the Chinese navy's inability to provide protection to ships, and the Chinese couldn't challenge the blockade. Okay, well, it might seem obvious that you need a superior navy, or at least a strong one, to enforce any kind of naval blockade. But this next story from the 1600s shows another approach. Let's set the scene with some background to what would be a 22-year-long blockade of Taiwan. So, the Ming Dynasty comes crashing down in 1644. As I recall, the last Ming emperor hangs himself rather than be captured. The Qing take the capital of Beijing. And that's the end of the illustrious Ming Dynasty.
You said crashing down. Yes, replaced by a new dynasty, the Qing. The Manchus, a people from beyond the Great Wall. But it was a slow-motion crash. It took decades for the transition. Among the greatest resistance came from Zheng Qianggong, or better known as Koxinga, head of a large trading network based in Fujian. After many years of fighting, he was forced to retreat to his island base of Xiamen along the Fujian coast.
And then, soon after, he had to cross the strait to Formosa for a new base. That was in 1661. Koxinga and his men were stubborn holdouts. The Manchus, who, as you noted, came from beyond north of the Great Wall, they were not into sailing at all. But they had captured China, and therefore they had the Chinese Navy. But the Chinese Navy at this point is still not ready to take on Koxinga's fleet.
After 15 years of fighting, the Qing began a new policy, that of coastal depopulation.
So that would be a de facto blockade of Taiwan by denying supplies from China. So that would include food and any other kind of trade. And you could say it was a scorched earth kind of policy.
Yes, the Qing court ordered all coastal residents to move inland on pain of death. And then the Qing burned 1,000 miles of coast, homes and livelihoods destroyed.
And it wasn't just that these people were forced to move. These former coastal residents were banned from being near the coast. Fishing, farming, whatever. If you were near the coast, getting caught could mean death.
A brutal policy, and it lasted from 1661 to 1683.
1661, the year Koxinga retreated to Formosa, and 1683, the year in which the Qing seized Formosa from Koxinga's grandson, I believe.
The policy started with some localized deportations and grew until 5 coastal provinces were affected. Fujian was the worst hit, and secondly was the province to the south, Guangdong.
It's easy to have a policy, to issue an edict from Peking, but this is an age of very poor communications and a wild, far-flung, lawless region. So how do you implement something like this?
Right. So it was not one massive coordinated evacuation. It happened in various ways. But the general process was survey the area, draw up lines of demarcation, perform a military operation, forcing people behind the line, burn down buildings and such, and then build trenches and walls to mark the boundary. And then to make it easier to enforce, they would have trenches and walls. And they'd militarize that walled line, post troops, build garrisons.
So if they weren't able to access the sea, then they can't fish, right?
Correct.
And fishing was an important part of the life of people from Fujian and Guangdong and other places.
Yes, incredible. It's a horrendous policy, isn't it?
Yeah, it's incredible to think about. But going back to Fujian and this line of demarcation you said, do you have any more specifics?
Sure, but to give credit where it's due, the information I'm giving you comes from a wonderful book, Sea Rovers, Silver and Samurai, Maritime East Asia in Global History, 1550 to 1700.
Sea Rovers, Silver, and Samurai. Nice alliteration. So some listeners will recall that silver was the main currency of the time. And Sea Rovers, well, that would be a term for pirates.
Yes, a reference to Woko, a so-called Japanese pirates. But the crews were of mixed nationality, predominantly Chinese. Anyway, this book is a collection from various academics, and I'm drawing on chapter 12, The Burning Shore, Fujian and the Coastal Depopulation, 1661 to 1683 by Darpon David Ho.
Okay, I'll put all those details up on our website, but I got to go back to this demarcation line. How do you mark a place so large?
Okay, the lines were marked, but the Qing soldiers put fixed poles in the ground, then connected them with ropes, which sounds like they're surveying, but it was pretty roughly done. The distance from the sea varied, but typically a distance of 30 li.
Li, that's an old Chinese measurement. Most famously, people may have heard of this Li, and they might not even know it. It's in the name of the Great Wall of China. The Chinese name is Wan Li Changcheng, so Wan is 10,000 li. So 10,000 li long wall.
Right, and there's an ancient saying from the Tao Te Ching, a classic book. A journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step, but in fact refers to 1,000 li.
Okay, remind me, how far is a li? Half a kilometer, right?
Yeah, half a kilometer, yeah.
So a more accurate translation would be, a journey of about 500 meters begins with a single step.
Full marks for accuracy there, Eric, but not quite as poetic.
No, not at all. So let's get back to coastal depopulation. 30 li from the coast, that's about 15 kilometers.
Yes, but that's just an approximate number. The border varied. It might be 5 kilometers or as much as 25.
Wow, 5 to 25 kilometers from the coast, all verboten land.
Right. The distance depended on the particular situation, the topography, the location of cities and such.
Forcing all those people out, people who have had generations of connection to the sea, it's tyrannical. I can imagine quite a few people thinking, hey, let's just go to Taiwan.
Yep. Some went to Taiwan, others headed to Southeast Asia. You know, the Fujian people had a long trading relationship with Southeast Asia.
So there was a bit of a diaspora following this 22-year or during this 22-year scorched earth, no coast policy?
Right. There had been contacts before this, but they were strengthened by having these populations move out.
Okay, so back on the China coast in the 1600s, rough lines are drawn up and residents were told to leave in 3 days to a week. And then troops would turn up and burn everything. Then eventually they dug those trenches, put up a few walls, and those were built to help mark the line.
Yes, and these walls and trenches often went together.
Yeah, it makes sense. You dig the trench and then you have all that earth and you can use that to, I don't know, make a wall, yeah?
Mm-hmm. A trench and above them walls. And these walls were perhaps 12 feet high and 5 feet thick.
That's impressive. Not built by soldiers, though, right?
The newly homeless coastal residents press-ganged into labor, I think.
Wow. And how did that work in practice?
I'm not sure. Sometimes prisoners, paid laborers, and other times they might assign a particular household or village a certain length of wall.
So back to the depopulated strip of land. When we think of Qing soldiers, it's easy to imagine wild mounted troops from the north, but there certainly weren't enough of them.
Right, too few of them. So local people were involved, local people and a lot of them hired to set fires and do other work.
So this would be somewhat ironic. You're talking about these same people who were being forced out of their homes, forced away from the coast, taking part in the destruction of their homes.
The flood of refugee coastal dwellers caused trouble for their fellow Fujianese on the other side of the boundary. It's already a hellscape, but it's decimated by years of fighting. And now these new desperate incomers who pillage crops, steal chickens and pigs and so on.
And stealing pigs and chickens and so forth didn't make these newcomers all that popular. There's an amazing quote from that book you mentioned earlier. It says, quote, "Even today, although the coastal wall has long since disappeared, a folk tradition in Putian remains. And this tradition is more like a saying, and the saying is this, quote, a good woman doesn't marry a man from outside the boundary."
Wow. Reminds me of my Scottish mum. I was, from a young age, forbidden to marry a Campbell because of a massacre that took place in, oh, I think, 1693 in Scotland.
That's hilarious.
Anyway, yeah, back in Fujian, desperate people, you know, life's cheap. So you do what you can to survive. Some coastal refugees teamed up with criminals and attacked villages, you know, robbing and kidnapping girls and women. Well, maybe abduct is better than kidnap as a word, because they would often be sold as wives or worse.
Nasty business.
There was a Qing policy which kind of backfired. Their amnesty policy from sailors from the Zheng Empire. Koxinga is dead and his son is in charge. And if the seamen surrendered to the Qing, they could keep their ranks.
So normally when your side is losing, if you decide to defect or desert, your life is at risk. Number one, from your own side, you know, you get executed for desertion in wartime. Or if you go to the other side, they might send you off to be cannon fodder somewhere, or you might end up as some laborer digging ditches. But with this amnesty offer, you surrender to the Qing, you keep your head, number one, you get a new job, or at least you're on the payroll, you get some sort of income.
Yeah, I'm not sure on the exact details, but here's an interesting story related to the amnesty. It created an incentive for some of these jobless evacuees to try and pass themselves off as Zheng sailors from Formosa.
So essentially bogus defectors, previously fishermen or farmers, and now pretending, oh yeah, I was in Zheng Chengong's navy.
It would take some organizing, you know, working with outlaw gangs, but they'd sneak out through the no man's land to sea and then come in to surrender.
Yeah, kind of a quote-unquote surrender, yeah? But they couldn't come home right away. There was one issue. It's kind of funny. They had to grow their hair. All the subject of the Qing, right? They had to shave their foreheads and wear their braided queue thing.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting detail, right? So, yeah, they'd hang out with these band of outlaws at offshore islands, perhaps engage in some piracy and such. Then, when their hair looked suitably long and rebellious, they could surrender. And part of that surrender was getting a new ugly hairstyle with a shaved forehead.
Very ugly. And if we continue reading from the book Sea Rovers, Silver, and Samurai, it says, quote, "As soon as they received their cash rewards, they simply jumped the wall, got back on their boats, and regrew their hair. Then they would revisit the coast to plunder, and then turn themselves in again. They made enough to bribe local officials to look the other way. So if it was so easy to do this back and forth, it raises a question, how effective was this coastal depopulation policy in general? Did it actually lead to the defeat of the Zheng regime on Formosa, or the Dongning Kingdom, as it was called?
It put pressure on Taiwan, but there were ways around it. Bribery with corrupt local officials, and Zheng family maritime trading empire extended to Southeast Asia, so they weren't entirely dependent on China. It was actually military overreach that really brought about the fall of Formosa to Qing forces.
Right. In the early 1670s, there was a widespread series of uprisings, a civil war, you could say. It was known as the Revolt of the Three Feudatories. A feudatory is like a vassal state. So you submit to a stronger power, but you're still technically independent. Fujian had the misfortune of being under a very greedy and cruel Qing military commander. So this commander, he squeezed the local population for every coin they had. And when this rebellion looked like it might succeed, he joined in. That was in 1674.
Koxinga's son, Zhang Jing, saw this as a moment to retake territory on the mainland and to perhaps overthrow the Qing. So he and the rebelling commander in Fujian, they're two enemies. They've been fighting, but they made an alliance. This alliance broke down almost immediately, so they fought, as well as fighting the Qing forces. There's a lot of fighting, poor people in Fujian.
Okay, so let me see if I'm understanding this correctly. So in Fujian, there's a nasty military commander, and he basically defects for a little while to work with Kushinga's son, but then they start fighting again. And
well, he joins this rebellion in China with these two other feudatories. So now his former enemy, Zheng family on Formosa, they're fighting the same enemy, the Qing. So they have an alliance, but it breaks down, and they end up fighting as well.
So when you're talking about overreach, it's the son of Zheng Hongong trying to recapture territory in China.
Yeah, he squandered his forces fighting in China, which was both against this local commander and the Qing forces.
So this local commander, the surname was Gong, he surrendered. Mm-hmm. And 5 years later, he was executed for treason by what is often called death by a thousand cuts. It was very slow, and its name is actually pretty literally true.
Yeah, we won't go into that.
Yeah. So the revolt of what we talked about just earlier, these three feudatories, was finally crushed in 1681, and the Qing now can turn their eyes to conquering Formosa, weakened Formosa. And indeed, Formosa surrendered in 1683.
And with that, the coastal depopulation policy came to an end. There had been a partial relaxation of it in the late 1660s, 1668. But basically, it had lasted for 20 years.
And do we have any numbers about the death toll from this policy?
Hard to say. It's difficult to separate the deaths from the Ming-Qing fighting, the revolt, to separate those deaths from those caused by the coastal depopulation itself, but perhaps a quarter of a million, and many millions more suffered. As far as I know, this was the worst maritime prohibition in history.
Yeah, it's a little known yet fascinating episode in history, and as was the French blockade. It's rather surprising that French ships were parked outside of Kaohsiung stopping traffic.
Yeah, we're kind of immune to the shock, but I recall first reading about it, and you're thinking, French in Taiwan? French blockading, fighting in Taiwan? It's quite a surprise.
Mm. So, before we go, do we have any other Taiwan blockade stories?
Oh, yeah. There's a huge Taiwan-China story we haven't told, and it's one with an unexpected twist to it.
Yep, because this time it was Taiwan, or more specifically the Republic of China on Taiwan, blockading the Chinese coast in the 1950s. It's a wonderful story, but we've run out of time today. Hope everyone's been enjoying the summer. Thanks for listening to Formosa Files. I'm Eric Michael Smith.
Bye.